left off. We're going to talk about methods used to break World War II crypto systems as a leaping off point to understanding what the vulnerabilities are in the systems and the way they're used. The first example here, so we have pictures of a couple of interesting things. On the bottom right, you see the picture of Bletchley Park in England, which is essentially an old, rich person's mansion where the crypto guys had set up in the basement, I guess. And Alan Turing, I guess, and others worked there during World War II. They were cryptographers, and what they did mostly was decipher German and mostly German codes made with the Enigma machine. And they did this, among other things, with the use of a special computer that they built, which was one of the first computers ever to exist. Certainly one of the first electromagnetic computers, and that was called Colossus. You may remember the movie called Colossus, the Forbin Project, or if you haven't, you should see it. It's one where a computer, essentially, or a set of computers take over the world. And it's a fun movie to watch. It makes you sort of think about the web these days. So let's see. First of all, there were many World War II ciphers, but mainly there were Japanese, German, and Allied ciphers. And the Japanese and German ciphers are what we're going to focus on here. There wasn't very much breaking of Allied ciphers by the Japanese because the Japanese didn't know how to break their own codes and figured that if we couldn't break, if they couldn't break their codes, we couldn't break their codes, and they couldn't break our codes, they just figured that was the end of the story. Germany was sort of busy doing other things, and they didn't have a very massive code breaking, but they did have a very substantial intelligence network. The German intelligence network, for example, in Great Britain, every German intelligence agency in Great Britain was turned and ended up working for the British, feeding false information to Hitler. Basically, they were all caught and given the option of work for us or die. And so they chose survival over the fatherland. Common flaws in these systems are what allowed the exploits. Many of them are the same flaws we find in crypto systems today. One of the real good reasons to study history, especially in cryptography, is that so many problems are repeats of the past. And if you notice, also in the rest of information protection, computer security, we find the same flaws now that we found 10, 15, 20 years ago. So there's a saying about this, those that ignore history are destined to repeat it or something. Many of these are human behavioral issues. They don't have to do with the mathematics of the crypto system or something like that. Whereas everybody talks about the mathematics of the crypto system as being the heart of the matter, it's really not. So some examples of human flaws in World War II in Japan. As I mentioned, they assumed that since they couldn't break their codes, nobody else could. That's a real bad mistake to make. Another one is they used repeated code words that were unchanged for way too long. So, for example, they had code words that represented islands that were territories, their territories, and territories of other groups, mostly the United States. So when the U.S., there was a famous case related to Midway Island. They were trying to make sure that the codes that they were breaking were the right codes. So this is an example of falling to a deception. The Allies had open communications about various things on various islands and other encrypted communications or coded communications. So one of the things they did was they, on one of the islands related to the Midway situation, they released information about a broken water heater or some such thing. And they waited to see the Japanese intercept. It was false information. And it was the only place that that communication took place. And they waited for the code word associated with that island to be used in conjunction with a report that said that they had a broken water heater. And so they listened to this Japanese intelligence report and found out or confirmed that the code word was what they thought it was for that island and that that's where an attack was going to take place. And so they were able to set up an ambush. And so there are many such deceptions. They assumed language differences would help them. But it turned out the U.S. had Japanese-speaking code breakers. So these were people who either had native Japanese or were very good at Japanese, Americans that had lived in Japan for a long time, and also had other code-breaking skills, or worked with people with code-breaking skills. And so that assumption was a bad one, and that hurt them a lot. They had real problems with key distribution and key reuse, and we'll talk more about some of these issues later, but so they didn't have an adequate system of distributing new keys or of preventing the reuse of old keys. And then there are initialization problems and traffic analysis. And a typical example of traffic analysis is these things would be sent over Morse code or some such code using the wireless. So one of the things people could do is tell the hand of the wireless operator. They could just tell by the way they tapped that this was operator number 35 as opposed to operator number 70. And by telling how they tapped, they could tell other characteristics. For example, how people were working, what their shifts were. Right? This guy always woke up at 9 o'clock in the morning. Today he's up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Something's different. Okay. Another example is that the same person, the same two operators might know each other and have some communication about their girlfriend. So what will happen is you'll recognize the two hands. You'll be able to pull out the communication about the girlfriend because you know it's always the first thing they talk about. And then, based on knowing what some of the plain text is, it's a known plain text attack, you might be able to defeat the crypto system because you know some of the plain text that's being encrypted. You might be able to derive part of the key from that and then decode some of the rest of the message. So that's a, sort of a typical example of the flaws in that. Germany had many similar things. One of them is they assumed that the Allies didn't have details of the Enigma machine for a long time, when in fact they did. What happened was, there was a group of Polish mathematicians, and they went to England near the beginning of the war, and they had designed the machine before that current version of the Enigma. So they knew how it worked, and they understood the mathematics of it better than anybody else, and they helped break the code. And then there were a couple of times when the Allies got copies that they got one of the submarines, a German submarine that they attacked. They managed to get the submarine, take it before they could destroy the code machines. And so they got a copy of the German naval Enigma with the keys. So of course that's very useful. And then in order to make sure that nobody understood that, they essentially proclaimed new tactics, right? They said, you know, in some sort of a subtle way, they maybe pushed back through the spies in England that were turned, that the Allies had changed tactics, and therefore they were getting a lot more of the submarines. So there was another example is in the Battle of Britain, they were breaking German codes and shooting down German flights or repositioning some of the things the Germans used to figure out where to drop the bombs, forging radio signals and so forth, to cause the Germans to drop the bombs in the wrong places. But they didn't want to yield their hand about having broken the code because it was too valuable. So in many cases, they allowed things to proceed unhindered or created other excuses for defeating the attack. So there was a lot of perception management involved in keeping the Germans of the belief that the Allies didn't have the Enigma. In fact, there were a couple of times when Germans in the hierarchy suspected that there was somebody with a copy of the Enigma, but some intelligence report was sent back to say that it wasn't true or some such thing. So, it had a lot to do with, Germany made a lot of mistakes because Hitler was in charge. That's another issue. Another one is Germans used similar initiation messages, closing messages and phrases. So again, known plain text. I don't remember the specifics, but one of them was something along the lines of not Heil Hitler, there was some common phrase used in Germany. Another one is whenever they would set up the machines, they would, just to test it out, they'd start at the beginning of the day with some standard message, you know, hi, this is station 17 or something like that. And so knowing that the first, you know, bits coming out of this thing were, hi, this is station, and their station number, and knowing their station number, gave a tremendous advantage because they could, again, attack the keys. So they'd change the key every day and then use a standard message, and then that would help the Allies break the key, and then they'd have the key for the day. The hand, user hand also linked the phrases, as in the case with the Japanese. There were various traffic analysis problems. Again, the presence or absence or quantity or timing of traffic and individuals indicates things. triangulation of the location of the machine where that hand is being used corresponds to that individual who is the crypto guy for this known general moving from place to place. So you could track the movements of key personnel, for example, or key units in their military by triangulating and associating that with the hand. Again, they assumed that since they couldn't break it, nobody else could. And they ignored evidence of failures when plausible alternatives were found. Examples of mostly human reasons and the way you use the system causing its failure, not just the system itself. There were also some amazing technical breakthroughs related to cryptography in World War II. The picture here at the left is the Enigma machine. That's what it looked like. Essentially, you would set these wheels that are setting up near the top of the blue part of the machine, and that would be your daily code. And you would then start typing, and what you typed on the keyboard would generate different codes, coded answers. Actually, it would light the lights, and so you'd write down whatever the light was, and then you'd send a sequence of lit letters. And the wheels up at the top would rotate, and after one would rotate so far, the next one would rotate one click or something like that. And there were wires running through and across the wheels to make different connections to change the electrical connectivity so that every time you pushed, if you pushed A again and again and again, you'd get a different sequence of letters out, different letter time after time after time. The thing over on the right is this Colossus machine, which was a very, very small computer compared to some of the bigger computers, but it was one of the first computers in the world, if not certainly one of the first. And there were a variety of things they used with Colossus. Well, one thing that of course they did was they just did the sorts of computation that you're used to. But there's another variety of things that they did. One is they used optical computing for very highly parallel breaking of Enigma ciphers. What they would do is they would code essentially ones and zeros on film. And they would code a portion of a message on a film and make films for different keys running through Enigma machines. So for example, for the standard message, "Hi, how are you?" if that was or station 17 porting in, they would code that under a whole bunch of keys and then just view the optics one after the other after the other after the other and compare them, and when they saw something where the optics lined up, they'd say, aha, this is a similar key. So they used human optical processing in combination with building special films to be able to break codes and all sorts of things like this. So it was a sort of a fascinating time for all sorts of things. In fact, optical computing then is probably as advanced as optical computing now. There are other aspects of theory. Remember, we talked last time about workload. And another way to think about workload is as computational leverage. The object is to use little computation to create a ciphertext from a plaintext and the encryption key. Use a small amount of computation to get back the plaintext from the ciphertext and a decryption key. But force the attacker to take lots of computation to get the plaintext from the ciphertext without the decryption key. Lots of computation to generate ciphertext from the plaintext without the encryption key. And lots of computation to get the encryption or decryption key from the ciphertext and the plaintext, or from the ciphertext alone. So what you're trying to do here is essentially make the space bigger relative to the thing that you're searching for, in the analogy of the space that we talked about before. There are lots of different kinds of systems, and so we're going to go through some of these. There's the N key systems. What you've been seeing here are one key and two key systems, right? The two systems we've been talking about, the RSA and the DES are examples, or the Enigma. The Enigma, you had the same key on both sides for encrypt and decrypt, so that's a one key system. The signature and encryption scheme using RSA has a public key and a private key, that's a two key system. But you can have arbitrary N key systems for various purposes. For example, there are multi-person signature schemes that, for example, would require five people to agree before a bomb went boom. And that So everybody has their own key, and they each sort of partially agree. And when you get enough agreements, then the whole agreement happens. And of course, the next sort of version of that is M of N, as you don't, that's actually one of the later bullets on the page. But in an M of N system, you want to make sure, for example, that out of the 10 people that are authorized to transfer $1 billion, you need 6 of them to agree. Any 6 of them. So if one of them gets hit in a car crash, you can still do the job. Right? And of course, if 5 of them get killed, then you can't transfer the money anymore. At least not using the crypto system, and you have to go redeploy another crypto system to take over that process. But it's very handy for that purpose. And of course, that makes it attackable. All you need to do is kill off N minus N people, and that system will fail to function properly for a while. Or destroy M of N keys, or corrupt them, or what have you. So there are various, there's the signature scheme that takes multiple persons to make something happen, or decryption schemes that take multiple people to allow you to read a message, and encryption schemes. To make a valid message, it takes multiple keys. So an example of the way to do this is by solving N equations in N unknowns. So this is an example of an N key crypto system. Where you have 3 equations right there, and you just create a random matrix. That is, for the x squared, x, and constant arguments of a quadratic equation, you put in random numbers. Okay, so you now have 3 equations. You'd like x, y, and z here. You have 3 unknowns. So you have so many times x, so many times y, plus so many times z is equal to a constant. So what you would do then is you have 3 equations and 3 unknowns, and you know that you can't solve n equations in n plus 1 unknowns, right? It's impossible, because there are infinite number of solutions to n equations in n plus 1 unknowns. You need all n equations to solve n unknowns. If there are k unknowns, you need k equations. Okay, so that means that you would require k people, each with their own line of this thing, to be able to provide a proper solution to the problem. So you distribute 1 row to each participant. You can encrypt the message using all n keys by solving the equations, getting the value for a, b, and c, and then you say, we want to solve it for the answer 53. We want to send the message 53 or 139 or what have you. So you solve it for all the equations for the answer equal to 139, and you then split it up into the sub-equations. Each person has their sub-equation, and you can't regenerate the 139 from any less than all n equations. Now, you know that you can always add another row, right? If you have n equations and n unknowns, you can make n plus 1 equations in n unknowns just by adding another equation that's the sum or the difference, or multiply any equation by a constant or something like that. So if I want an M of N system, I have M equations and M unknowns, and I generate an additional N minus M equations. And I just hand them out. And now I have an M of N crypto system, just using so many equations and so many unknowns as a scheme. So you can encrypt, you can sign, you can decrypt with this. And it's perfect, right? That is, there's no way, if you have less than n equations, to break it. Right? Because there are an infinite number of possibilities. It can be any real number. Okay? So in that sense, it's a perfect crypto system. You don't have enough information to solve it unless you have the right number. There's some interesting questions that you might want to ask. So we're going to go through some of them. One of them is, how much does the attacker learn from watching the system operate? We saw these World War II examples where just watching the hand of the individual user moving from place to place told you all sorts of information. Right? It's not defeating the crypto system directly, but it's exploiting the crypto system against the people using it. How soon do they answer? What time do they answer? You can talk, find out patterns of movement and location and so forth. G we're watching the system operate, and we happen to notice that all the blocks are 56 bytes long. excuse me. 56 bytes. What crypto systems are 56 byte crypto systems? So there are all sorts of things like the length of the things being sent, the frequency with which they're sent, the amount of time it takes for something to happen that will tell you where it's from and where it's to. This will tell you a great deal of information about what system is being used, how it's being used, who it's being used, when it's being used, and so forth. Another interesting question to ask yourself is, what if the attacker guesses some things and they're right? How does that affect the result? Okay, this is a particularly interesting question because I can guess all sorts of things and I might be right. Suppose I guess that you're using a triple DES. I don't have any idea what you're using. I just guessed it was a triple DES. Suppose I'm right. How much of an advantage does that give me? Okay. I guess that the first message you say is, "Hi, Joe," whenever you talk to Joe. Because I've seen your plain text correspondence. Or you're encrypting email. And I get email. I've seen email from you posted on bulletin boards, and it has your signature line on it. And I'm just going to guess that your signature line appears in your encrypted emails, too. Now I have a plain text ciphertext pair. If your signature is long enough and the block size is short enough, I may know the plain text of a whole block near the end of the message, or several whole blocks near the end of your message. How much of an advantage does that give me in being able to break the key or find out other things about your message? Another one is, what can the attacker reasonably guess? So everything I've listed here are things that you could reasonably guess. There's lots of these questions. Another one, what can the attacker reasonably guess? Oh, what can the attacker reasonably induce? We'll get to that later. How about this? Does keeping the encryption or the decryption transform secret increase the workload, and to what extent? Is it really an advantage to have a secret transform? There are lots of people in the industry that have tried secret transforms, and they find some things. The DVD people, recently, they had their secret transform. Nobody's supposed to know about it. First of all, I guess that means not enough experts knew about it, so they didn't find out that it was breakable. Second problem was that the bad guys figured it out pretty quickly. Another problem is, in a lawsuit, the lawyer, as part of his filing, included the details. And since things filed in lawsuits are now a matter of public record, the whole scheme is public record. Anybody can get it. Also, of course, I can then publish it without recourse, because it's public record. I can just publish the public record. Here's their scheme. So keeping it secret is also, of course, difficult. That doesn't mean you shouldn't ever keep it secret. It means that you risk losing that secret, and if you lose that secret, what's the impact? How does that increase workload to have it secret as opposed to not secret? And in fact, can we count on secret transforms, and under what occasions? People out in the crypto world, at least in the public side of the crypto world, keep telling us that we can't count on secret transforms. If they have to keep the transform secret, it can't be any good. Baloney. There may be tremendous advantages to somebody not knowing what transform you're using. Suppose I encrypt files and then I send them in FTP. Okay, the FTP won't reveal the encryption method. If I don't do it automatically in response to their request, there won't be a simple way to tell from how much time it took to encrypt it. Suppose I just store them on my web server encrypted. And then anybody can pull them off and decrypt them at their leisure. Well, so if they don't know what the crypto system is, it makes it a lot more difficult for them to be able to attack it. Of course, there aren't that many crypto systems, but if it increases their workload by a factor of 20, that's a lot. It's a big factor in some cases. Maybe it's enough to make the difference. Here's some more questions. Can we use the encryption key or the decryption key forever? Now, we saw from Shannon's theory that after you get to 2.6 times the length of the encryption key or the decryption key, the message, in theory, can be broken. On the other hand, is there really a difference between using it 3 times the length of the key or 300 times the length of the key or 300,000 times the length of the key? Or is there a difference between 1 day and 10 days and 100 days and 1,000 days and a millennium? Now, of course, one thing to note is, if we know how much time it takes to break a key, and we're not concerned about keeping secrets forever, but only about, for example, assuring the integrity of a transaction, or the inability to forge a financial transaction, then it might be perfectly adequate to keep these keys for, oh, say, 3 or 4 days, change them once a week, because we believe that it takes an average of 25 years to break it. So, fine, 25 years, if you get really lucky, 12 years later, 10 years, 2 years later, 6 months later, you can have it broken. But it won't do you any good. Because, yeah, you can read my transactions, but they were in the plain text anyway. I was only using it for authentication. So the question is, how long and how do you determine it? And there's no definitive answer to that question because it depends on a lot of other factors. For example, if how long is affected by what I know about your crypto system, then how do you know what I know about your crypto system? That goes back to what the threat is. Right? If the threat is an insider, I know everything about your crypto system. I may even know the key. Right? Depending on how inside they are. So in order to do the analysis, you have to understand the whole picture. It's a big, complex picture that you need to understand. Can you trust cryptography to keep secrets for a long time? And if so, how long and why? Now, let me give you a couple examples. Can you trust cryptography to keep, suppose you encrypted with a DES on your machine, your current bank statement? Can you trust that for 6 months not to be broken? Well, gee, breaking it, first of all, probably costs a fair amount of money to break a DES, just a simple DES encryption. It takes a couple of days for a whole bunch of computers sitting out on the internet. And, gee, who would really want to break my, you know, bank statement, considering you could probably just go to my trash and pick it out? So, gee, maybe I can trust crypto for that because it's not that important. There are other means that are easier than the crypto means for breaking it. Suppose you wanted to keep, you know, the secret of how nuclear weapons work for 50 years. Could you trust a DES? Probably not. Because we certainly know that all the foreign governments in the world, or any substantial one, has the ability to break DES. So if they have the ability to record some of this information, and we use DES, they'll be able to break it. And if it takes them a year to break it, that's not 50 years. So again, you need to answer these questions. How about this one? Can cryptography be used to assure integrity or identity? And to what extent? Under what circumstances? See, people just throw crypto at something. They'll say, I use cryptography. It assures that the transaction isn't modified en route. Yes, that's true. On the other hand, if I modify the transaction before it gets en route, then the integrity of your whole system falls over. Right? It only covers what it covers. So assure, yes, we can assure something to some extent, but what are we assuring and to what extent? So most people, when they do crypto systems, don't come to grips with what they're really assuring and to what extent they're assuring that. Suppose I use encryption, cryptography, to try to assure integrity by encrypting something and figuring it won't come out in plain text on the other side. So whenever they read the other side, it'll look like garbage. Will that work? Well, gee. You know about software, garbage in, garbage out. If I don't have a good garbage filter on the front end, I'll get garbage in, and I may interpret that garbage as a legitimate transaction. So it's fine to say that cryptography is providing some assurance, but how much assurance? What portion of the messages that could be randomly generated, for example, could come through here? How about replays? If I sent the same message again, would it work again? Am I really assuring integrity if I don't prevent replay attacks? How about identity? Suppose I take your thumbprint and I encrypt it, and I use that to show who you are, and you have to come up and give me your thumbprint, and I'll send that thumbprint signature that you give me over the network for comparison to the original. Will that assure my identity? Well, how about if I can insert a copy of my original signature to a replay attack? it doesn't assure integrity at all. Right? It only assures it to the extent that the crypto covers the issue, and only to within the probability scheme that the crypto provides you, and only to the extent that the listening party is able to do a proper differentiation, and only. It's a whole bunch of ands. And most people that look at these, and most systems you find out on the market, don't address the ands. If you don't address all the ands, your system's likely to collapse under a concerted attack. How much does the attacker learn from watching the system operate? Here's some examples. Covert channels are common in crypto systems. For example, Secure Shell. Have you ever watched a Secure Shell session? Well, that's tough. Secure Shell session. If you sniff traffic and watch a Secure Shell session, you'll be able to tell the difference between an LS command and a, what's another command? And a grep command. By the input, by the output, by the timing, you can tell. You can probably tell what commands they're typing and in what order. You can probably tell what applications they're running. Okay? If I'm using Secure Shell and I open up X11, you think I can tell? It's going to be so obvious because the blast of traffic and the pattern sequence of the traffic is going to tell me they're running an X11 over that Secure Shell link. Or they're running an FTP or an SCP. What protocol, how much data they're transferring. How big a file they moved. What time and date they moved it. Where they moved it from, where they moved it to. I might be able to tell something about their user ID and their password by the length of the packet that was sent. They have a 3-byte password. Okay? So there are all sorts of things you can watch by just seeing this behavior. Another example is the Kerberos key management system. I think we mentioned this earlier, but I'll go through it again. Kerberos key management, before some fairly recent changes, and maybe still the case, what happened was you would use your public-private key to ask for a session key between you and some other host, and the Kerberos server would generate a session key based on time. And there would only be a few million possible keys that could have been generated at a given time. So by watching the timing of the provision of the session key, I could go break the session key, look at a couple packets, try a few million possibilities, figure out what the session key is, and now break all the traffic between the two parties. Okay, and in fact, I could also forge traffic between the two parties. That's by a covert channel in the way the key was generated in the Kerberos server. Right, it's a covert channel. It's not a channel intended for information to flow. It's covert. It's something I just found out by watching it and by information passing through it. Traffic analysis we've been discussing. When is the traffic used? Time of day? Under what circumstance? From where to where? We only see traffic between the president's office in the White House and this person on the Joint Chiefs of Staff within 3 hours before attacks take place. So they're planning on the raid on Iraq, and we watch the traffic, and bingo, it's going to be the next 3 hours. Thank you for telling us. Now we're prepared. Right? We will pre-deploy something that will damage them. Knowing when you're going to be attacked is a big advantage. Look for changes in operation. You know, the way people use systems change with time and with circumstance. So these are all things that are part of traffic analysis. It can be countered by constant external behavior. Okay, so all you have to do is constantly use the maximum bandwidth you're ever going to use, sending garbage traffic in a pattern that's identical to the normal traffic pattern you're going to be using. And then when you actually want to send real information, that'll go over. Now, what's the impact of this in an environment like the internet? The internet is a shared bandwidth situation. So if you're going to have crypto that doesn't have these covert channels over the internet, you're going to have to consume the same amount of bandwidth all the time. That defeats the whole functional operation of packet switching. Okay, so you can't, in packet switching networks, without consuming lots and lots of resources and destroying the financial benefits of using packet switching, you cannot do crypto without traffic analysis. Ouch. Isn't this fun? By the time we're done, you're going to say, gee, what does cryptography have to do with cryptography? The answer might be nothing. It doesn't matter what code you use. You know, just the whole scheme that you're running in is more important. The attacker guesses some things, and if they're right, how does that affect the result? If I guess a key, can I tell that I'm right? All right, suppose I guess a DES key. Can I tell that I guessed the right key by decoding your messages? Or will the messages look the same garbage whether it's the right one or the wrong one? This has to do with getting back to Shannon's mathematics. Remember that the redundancy in the message is one of the key factors here, depending on your language. Well, suppose I compressed all my messages. So everything that was being sent over encryption was first compressed. Right, that would mean that the difference in message content, difference between the message content and the message size would be very nearly zero. And if you remember that equation, the bottom of the division had the difference between message content and message size. So if they're the same, or very nearly the same, then the denominator in that equation is very nearly zero. So the amount of message you have to be able to read to uniquely figure out whether this key is right becomes nearly infinite. So by using compression prior to encryption, you dramatically make this particular problem dramatically harder. Guessing the key doesn't necessarily mean you know you guessed the key. How about if I guess plain text ciphertext pairs, can I break the system? Right, you know, I can, if it's a one-time pad, and I know the plain text and the ciphertext, I know the bits of the one-time pad. That's the perfect system, right? It's absolutely perfect, except if I know plain text and ciphertext, it's not perfect anymore. If I guess the key, when the key was made and where it was made, does that help me break the system? Right, we've seen occasions where, in Kerberos, for example, where this was very specifically helpful, but it might give me a lot of other information. If I guess that you were changing keys every day at noon, can that help me attack you? Might be all sorts of ways. I might be able to interfere with your key exchange. I might be able to create a man-in-the-middle attack at the moment of your key exchange. I may be able to force you to use the old keys. I might be able to send you a fake key. I might be able to do all sorts of things knowing that that's at noon. There might be a short period of time at noon when you can't send any messages because you're busy changing keys. Maybe I can do something right during that period of time that you won't be able to let them know about in time. There are all sorts of potentials along those lines. How about what an attacker can reasonably guess? The type of system you're using, we've discussed that before. Almost every current crypto system that's in widespread use, you can, at first observation, very quickly tell me what type of system it is. If I secure shell, if you have secure shell running on a port, and I just telnet into the port 22 on that box, assuming it's running on port 22, it'll tell me what crypto systems are available, right? Which systems you might be using. Straightforward. How about why we're using it, you know? Will it help an attacker to guess, can they reasonably guess why we're using it? Are we using it just because we want to be private? Are we using it to transfer, you know, classified information? This would have a very significant impact if they could tell why we were using it on whether or not they would attack us. In fact, for some examples, you might want to just tell everybody, here's why I'm using encryption. Right? Because me and my mom want to exchange a private letter. I'm using encryption. Right in the header. Right? So don't bother. Leave my encryption alone. Of course, you can use a deception to say that's what it is. And so, I mean, if you've watched, you guys ever watched The Avengers? Old TV show? And The Avengers, you know, they had the one of the spy masters was called Father. That was the woman was called Father, and the man, male spy master, was called Mother. So you'd say, "Hello, Mother. How are the other kids doing?" You know, it's a code. It's a deception. So that if somebody's listening into that channel, they don't know what's going on, they'll be fooled. All right, some of the enemies won't be fooled, but some of them will. So it's an advantage. Maybe it helps get rid of other things. Can they tell what hardware we're using? Can they guess it? Can they induce it by sending signals, electronic signals, towards your hardware to figure out what kind of hardware it is? If I do an Nmap scan on your machine and I can figure out that it's running such and such a Linux, such and such a version, I might be able to defeat your crypto by breaking into the machine because I know a weakness of the machine. And now I can put a Trojan horse in your machine to defeat your crypto. If you're using a particular kind of hardware device to do encryption, I can tell what scheme you're using. If you're using a particular hardware device to do encryption, I might be able to induce a failure in that device by some electronic signal. Can they guess how we're doing key management? In most of the widely used crypto systems, the key management scheme is published. So knowing how we do key management gives you a big leg up on being able to interfere with key management functions. About one of our users' passwords. Yeah, almost always, some user out there has a weak password. If you find that user and you find the weak password and you get in, if you guess that, how badly is the system busted up? If you're using, say, a common DES key everywhere, and I get one user's password, I may be able to pick up their DES key, and if that's the same DES key everybody else is using, your whole system is falling over. It's got dead, gone, end of story. What portion of your system gets defeated as I guess more and more of this information? How about the combination to the front door? You have a combination lock on the front door. Right, so you got this fantastic crypto system, and everything's perfect about it, except that it has, you know, a combination on the front door that only has 400,000 keys on it. And I might be able to, you know, watch the guy punch it in with a telescope from across the street. So now I'm in the door, and your crypto system, as fantastic as it is defeated. How about if I figure out the person who knows the information being encrypted? You want to keep this secret. Suppose I can watch the behavior and figure out Billy Bob is the one who's doing all the encryption. Billy Bob knows the secret. I'll go grab Billy Bob off the street, start to slice him apart, and find out the secret information. Frankly, my preference is that nobody knows whether or not I know anything that might be secret. In fact, I tell people, and it happens to be true, that I don't know any secrets. In fact, what happens is every time I learn a secret, I publish it. You know? And if you tell me it's classified, I'll figure out a reason it's not. So I can not have to worry about trying to remember whether that was important or not, or how important, or why it was important. Well, so suppose you were carrying around some super secret classified information. Would you really want people to know that? Would you really want to have a badge that said, you know, I carry around super secret information, and oh yeah, it has to do with, you know, this kind of military secret, and, you know, and I work in this facility? No, I think I'd rather just have a, you know, little blank piece of paper somewhere. That's why, you know, most places that use badges say when you're not using your badge on site, put it in your pocket. Because they don't particularly want to be targeted. Right? Why advertise? Does keeping the encryption and decryption mechanism secret increase the workload, and to what extent? So, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, you have to figure out what the threat is and how well it does at figuring these things out. So, in World War II, they could have kept the fact that they were using an Enigma secret. In fact, they tried to keep it secret, but it didn't help them. So against a threat with a significant intelligence capability, it's very difficult to keep the transform secret. And if you're depending on the transforms being secret, then you have to have all the precautions surrounding the secrecy of the transforms that you have surrounding the secrecy of the keys, including all the transmission and all the protocols and everything about them, what the box looks like, its electronics, and so forth. Can they be observed by guessing traffic patterns? We've seen examples where you can do that very easily. Are we using a standard that's easily detectable? Right? Any standard crypto system, excuse me, oh, let's use standards. Well, any standard crypto systems, I can very quickly figure out what they are. If it's not a standard, you know, how do we know it's any good anyway? And in fact, how do we know it's any good if it is a standard? This whole question of how do you know how good it is, you know? So can we count on these secret transforms and under what circumstances? Here's a typical one. You'll see this in advertisements, at least you used to see it in advertisements. It says, the NSA approved our crypto system. Okay, approved it for what? They approved it for global release. Well, excuse me. Maybe they approved it for global release because it was easy to break and they could always read the messages and they wanted everybody to use it. You know, what are we talking about here? Relying on somebody else isn't particularly good. On the other hand, are you going to rely on yourself? Do you believe that you know as much as the best cryptographers in the world? I mean, I know enough to know that I don't know enough. How about this one? The Russian Secret Service created it to protect U.S. secrets. Can we trust it? I don't think so. Well, how about if the U.S. created it to protect Russian secrets? Absolutely not, right? I mean, you know, who do you trust? You trust yourself, but do you know enough? It's so secret that even the government doesn't know what it is. That's a good one. It's so poor that the government doesn't need to bother figuring out what it is. That's another way of saying that same sentence, right? You know, the Germans assumed the Enigma was a secret for much of the war, and that was a big, big mistake. In fact, a lot of people assert that it may have lost them the war, or at a minimum, you know, changed the outcome of the war by several years. A lot of people assert that cryptography was one of the most important things that the Allies did better than the Germans in World War II, and that it was the difference. Can we use encryption or decryption forever, and how long, and how we determine it? Well, we know this unicity distance thing tells that it's breakable after 2.6 times the key length. But there are other methods of assessing exposure associated with a key. For example, potential damage from one key's theft. If they take one of those keys, if they manage to guess one of the keys, or if they manage to steal one of the keys, how bad is it? What's the exposure, it's called? How about, you know, the number of exposures encountered? All right, suppose we assume that they can take one of these every few days. How much is the loss associated with that? How many exposures do we expect to happen? How many exposures have we found out about? How many keys have been lost? Right, people lose keys, people forget keys, people write them down. There are all sorts of things people do with keys. That's the nature of keys. How about the time to guess the key by exhaustion? Certainly you want to, you know, to know that would be a valuable thing to know. So we know with DES that we can exhaustively search the key space with current computers and parallelism reasonably quickly, and that therefore we should not trust it beyond that duration of time. If that level of threat is there. How about changes in key holders? Right? Somebody else becomes a key holder. Now, how much do you trust that key? We just changed jobs. So Jane, who used to be the vice president with that key, is no longer the vice president with the key. Does Jane hand her key to Joanne, the new vice president? Or do we have to create a whole new set of keys once Gene leaves the system because we can no longer trust that that key is secret? Could we trust it before if we can trust it after? If she knew she was leaving, maybe she secured the key and started to exploit it ahead of time. Number of missing keys and their import. I think it's fairly common, for example, with classified key systems that They periodically change the keys, but they might change it more often if more keys were missing or lost. I don't know why, they just, somebody figured it out. That's what they do. You trust crypto to keep secrets for a long time, and how long? How long, of course, depends on when it will be broken. So if you know when it'll be broken, then you know. You don't want to trust it beyond that length of time, but of course, how do we know that? So except for the one-time pad done right, not that anybody can ever really do it right, no system can be trusted to retain secrets indefinitely. Period. End of story. With great care, we might be able to design systems that are effective for reasonably short periods of time. Well, certainly for minutes, hours, maybe even days. Yeah, maybe. In special circumstances, we might be able to design systems that are good for a long time, but subject to a small number of uses and users. Right? So we might be able to figure out some special system that we can build, you know, right now, that'll be good for the next, you know, 200 years if only 18 people ever use them, see them, touch them, or anything else. You know, you're trusting multi-generations, right? You're trusting that your children's children's children will not reveal the key long after you're dead and gone. Very difficult to do that. It's hard to keep secrets for very long. It's hard to keep secrets for, you know, 15 minutes. You can use it to ensure integrity. Well, for a limited period of time, we can get a high degree of assurance that information cannot be altered without detection. In fact, a probability within delta. So for some short period of time, for a minute or two, I can have a very high assurance that nobody can alter something without detection. As the time goes up, I can't do so well. Crypto systems, the system that does cryptography, cannot be used to assure source integrity at all. As you cannot use cryptography to assure who it is that's at the other end. Not possible to do so. Because the other person is not within your crypto system. You can't use it to assure correspondence to reality. Right? Just because it's authenticated or encrypted or whatever doesn't mean that the input corresponded to the reality. The input that you then encrypted doesn't necessarily meet reality. It's a sunny day. Excuse me, it doesn't look very sunny to me, but I said it's a sunny day. We encrypted it, we authenticated it, we did all that, did key management right, but it's still not a sunny day. And encryption won't solve that problem. In fact, crypto systems can only cover very specific properties of information. So when you extend that beyond the information and the properties of that information to the systems, you're making a mistake. See, crypto systems can be used to authenticate identity, where we talk about something you know, you are, you have, or you can do. It's generally what we know about authentication of identity. And it can aid in improving assurance of identification systems. Make sure that certain parts of those identification systems work better than they might work without encryption or cryptography of some sort. So we can use them to improve certain aspects of it. I want to talk about implementation. So suppose the crypto system is fantastically good. Even if the crypto system is absolutely amazing, the implementation is almost always subvertible. Because of the key distribution, maintenance problems, the crypto protocol problem, the key scheduling problem, key generation and selection problem. Okay, now this is, we're still down in the mathematics of cryptography here. This isn't that I've knocked you over the head to get the secret, which of course I can do. This is within the system of implementation. Key distribution problem. Now, how do we get you a key without somebody else subverting the process? Okay, I want to send you some information. I want to do it in secret. How do I get you the key you need to be able to listen to the answer? How do I get me the key I need to be able to send the message? For example, we might be able to subvert it by stealing the key along the way, by replacing the key along the way, by preventing the distribution from taking place, corrupting the distribution key, The distributed key or the process used to distribute it. There's a difference between initial and subsequent distributions, and there's the ability to potentially redistribute old keys. Now, people talk about the RSA and other public key crypto systems being effective for key distribution because all I do is I send out my public key. I can freely send out my public key without any problem. That defeats stealing the key along the way. It doesn't defeat replacing the key. When you send out your key, if I put out a fake key instead of your key, and I remember your key, your system is busted. If I prevent your distribution, okay, you're ready to distribute your key, but your network connection's down, and it's not coming back up. Okay, I guess you're not going to be able to do that. Can't distribute the key, can't send the secret. I can corrupt the distribution key. As you send it out, I just screw it up. Doesn't decrypt anymore. That's the wrong answer. Oh well. End of your system. Corrupt the distribution process. So that, okay, you can distribute the key, but the process by which it gets from me to you doesn't work right. So it doesn't actually get from you to me, it gets from you to somebody else. All right, once you've established a distributed key, you might be able to then distribute new keys without the same sets of problems. You may have other problems. Some of these problems might still apply, but some of them might not apply. But the initial distribution is very different because it depends on some ethereal trust that there's no way to assure. I come up, I shake hands, you hand me the key. I say thank you. How do I know you're you? Right? Somebody walks up to somebody and says, hi, I'm Fred Cohen. Here's my key. We can talk in secret. Just use this key. Nobody else knows it. Thanks. Nice to meet you. They part ways. The person might even look like me. How do they know it's me? That's a big oops. And of course, redistribution of old keys. So all I do is I redistribute some old key that you used to have that's no good anymore. And now they say, oh, thanks for the new key. Oops. The key maintenance problem has things like, how do I keep the key secret? All right, so how do you keep a key secret? Right here, it's on my floppy disk. I have a floppy disk. My key is on my floppy disk. It's an absolute secret. Nobody can get this floppy disk. All right, I keep it on my person and stay conscious all the time. Of course, I can still steal it by, you know, picking my pocket or hitting me over the head or something like that. Or, you know, getting my attention, stealing it, copying it, and putting it back. You know. But, all right, now suppose I should actually at some point fall asleep. And by the way, you know, how many things am I going to keep for that level of security? So maybe we have guards and guns and gates and doors and all these things, locks. And behind the gate and the guard and the door and the lock and all this stuff, I put my key inside a security safe, and there it is. That key is now secret. Not. First of all, if at any time I ever have to take it out of that safe to use it, there's the potential for, oh gee, but how about the thing I plug it into to use it? If that's not secure, then my key isn't secure. Well, so now I have to do the same thing for the system that it plugs into, the whole set of transformation projects. Becomes a more complex issue. So that's a hard thing to do. People have various physical protection systems that do this to a certain extent, but it's not easy to do. All right, how do I revoke a key? You have a key to the door. I don't want you coming in the door anymore. How do I revoke the key? All right, well, I change the lock. If I ask you for the key back, that doesn't do very much, does it? Might have copied the key. So if I really want to revoke it, I have to change the lock. And then I have to redistribute those new keys for the lock to everybody else that's supposed to have a key. Oh, no. So revoking a key, then I have to redistribute all the other keys. All right, that's for that kind of lock. For the kinds of keys that we see in crypto systems over the internet, key revocation means we have to, what, send a copy notifying everybody that's ever gotten a copy of the key and anybody they've ever told, anybody they've ever told, saying this one's no good anymore. That's not going to work. I'm not logged in at the time. My computer system has changed. How do you update that whole process? Another alternative is that the key's not really valid until you check it against my central repository. So we revoke it by invalidating it at the central repository, in which case we've now changed the key from one of these large-scale distributed key systems, like what public key is supposed to be, into a system where we always have to check the central data bank to make sure it works right, a central system. Of course, then that's a single point of failure. How do I update keys over time? Very similar problem to keeping it secret and revoking it and distributing it, right? It's the combination of those, I guess. How do I keep them from being corrupted? Okay, look, I have a key on my disk. Oops, I walked through an electromagnetic field, my key is gone. Oh no! Oh no! I've gone through all this trouble, now I don't have a working key. What if I destroy the working key that is the key to let you use all the other working keys? Now all the keys are broken, now we have to redistribute all the keys. Becomes corrupted, it becomes lost. Oops, I lost it. Uh-oh, big problem. Now I have to revoke all of those, but I don't know how to revoke it because I don't have it. So I have to have it stored somewhere so I can recall it to revoke it. But if I have it stored somewhere to recall it to revoke it, then I can recall it and revoke it without having the key in the first place. Oh no! Big problem. Right, all these systems, all these schemes have these ever-increasing circles of things that you have to trust and so forth to get different levels of assurance. And of course, all of these systems have to have that same level of assurance. What are the trade-offs? You know, secrecy versus prevention of loss.